From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Is this man stood on the floor of the House of Representatives and said abortion is equivalent to murder? It's just like those other sound bites that I'm referring to when he's being critical of Clinton for invoking his privileges when he does the exact same thing.
What do you think of pornographer Larry Flynt exposing anti-abortion activist Congressmember Bob Barr's own support of his wife's abortion? We'll speak with leading feminists and a look at U.S. corporations exploiting workers in Saipan. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. House prosecutors led by Henry Hyde will begin presenting their impeachment case against President Clinton tomorrow afternoon. Hyde says the 13 prosecutors have been working on the presentation while discussing the ground rules on the possibility of calling witnesses. Sources say they'll treat the case like a conspiracy, alleging that Clinton's scheme to keep Monica Lewinsky from revealing their extramarital affair and ultimately plotted to ruin her reputation. Meanwhile, the White House brief is due at the Senate today. An outside advisor who is familiar with the document says it will suggest the House drew conclusions that went far beyond independent counsel Kenneth Starr's analysis. House officials have until noon today to turn over the written record in the impeachment case. Republicans are suggesting the White House may be involved in Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flynt's efforts to embarrass one of the House impeachment managers. The White House denies any such connection. Spokesman Joe Lockhart says Republicans should produce evidence or knock it off. Flynt has cited a deposition in which GOP Congressman Bob Barr used a legal privilege to avoid answering allegations of adultery during his 1986 divorce. He also revealed that Barr's second wife, Gail Barr, had an abortion in 1985 and that Barr had supported her even though he is a staunch abortion opponent. Interviewed on CNN, Barr said Flynt's accusations were a thinly veiled effort by the president's defenders to detract House prosecutors from presenting their case at the Senate impeachment trial. Iraq said today that its air defenses had hit a U.S. or British plane over the north of the country, but did not say whether it had been destroyed. A military spokesman said in a statement given to reporters that several formations of enemy planes entered Iraqi airspace. Iraqi air defenses, quote, opened fire on one of those enemy formations, the statement said. Went on to say our border observation post saw one of the enemy planes hit. Britain's highest court today granted Chile the right to be represented by lawyers at a new hearing next week into whether former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet has immunity from prosecution. The government of Chile wants to add itself to Pinochet's defense against extradition efforts by Spain to have him tried on charges of genocide and murder. The House of Lords ruled by 3-2 in November that his status as a former head of state did not preclude extradition proceedings from going ahead. But it set aside the ruling a month later after Pinochet's lawyers objected that one of the judges involved headed a charity associated with the human rights group Amnesty International. Nigerian police today fired shots and used tear gas to break up a protest against the military government by several dozen students in the commercial capital, Lagos. They said paramilitary police arrested at least seven of the university students who chanted slogans against military ruler General Abdeslami Abubakar and called for recent increases in school fees and fuel prices to be scrapped. Abubakar has faced increasing challenges to his authority in the past weeks. First, from the Ijaw people of the oil-producing Niger Delta, who were demanding that oil corporations dialogue with them and start exploiting their land, and since December by groups in Lagos, angered by fuel price rises and public sector wage cuts. They also have been protesting the brutality of the military regime. At last week's fuel protest in Lagos, at least five people were killed. The Supreme Court is being asked to decide if states can set welfare benefits based on residency. Justices will hear arguments today over California's proposed welfare plan, which would pay out benefits based on how long residents have lived in the state. People who just moved to California would receive the amount of money they would be eligible for in their old states. Welfare advocates argue that citizens have a fundamental right to choose where they live and that a state, quote, may not select its citizens. California officials say newcomers are not being discriminated against because they're no worse off than they would have been had they stayed in their original homes. This news from Riverside, California. Police there say four officers involved in the shooting death of a woman are now being threatened. The officers have been on paid leave since Taisha Miller was shot a dozen times last month while sitting in her car. Now activists are calling for a release of the officers' names and a tape of the 911 call that sent police to the scene. Miller's family has questioned whether racism played a role in the shooting because Miller was black and the officers were white and one was Hispanic. The Reverend Jesse Jackson has plans to visit the city because he says her death was a shockwave across the nation. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday night, Hustler publisher Larry Flint, best known for putting women through a meat grinder on the cover of his magazine in the 1970s, revealed that staunch anti-abortion Republican Bob Barr had supported and paid for his own wife's abortion years ago, and that he had had an extramarital affair. Barr is one of the House managers that are prosecuting President Clinton in his impeachment trial. In a surreal news conference at his Beverly Hills office, Flint said he had documentation to prove that Barr's second wife, Gail Vogel Barr, had had an abortion in 1985, including a receipt for the procedure. He added she had signed an affidavit saying that Barr had not objected to the procedure and had brought her to the clinic, picked her up afterwards, and taken care of the kids while she was there. Flint said he had decided to investigate politicians' private lives because he wanted to expose the hypocrisy going on in Congress today as they impeach and possibly beyond the president. Barr's track record in Congress on abortion speaks for itself. According to the pro-choice organization National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, he has a zero voting record on choice. In other words, he's voted against choice 100% of the time. He's also reported to have equaled abortion with murder, particularly disturbing at a time when anti-abortion extremist groups, prompted by inflammatory rhetoric on the part of the right wing, have been murdering abortion providers. We're going to turn right now to an excerpt of that news conference that not a lot of people heard, and this is Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, talking specifically about the issue of abortion and Georgia Congressmember Bob Barr.
Mr. Flint, in your discussions with the first wife, with Gail, did she ever explain why she had an abortion if he was so opposed to it?
She said that he wouldn't really take a position. And she says what you'll read in her affidavit, where she says that had I known he would not want me to have an abortion, I would not have had one. So, you see, the reason why, and I say this again, that this becomes so significant is this man stood on the floor of the House of Representatives and said abortion is equivalent to murder. It's just like those other sound bites that I'm referring to when he's being critical of Clinton for invoking his privileges, when he does the exact same thing in his divorce proceedings.
In your mind, is the question of the abortion more significant here than the question of taking essentially the Fifth Amendment? Because I watched Geraldo, and you spent a lot of time on the Fifth Amendment and no time on abortion.
Yeah. If you remember, I wanted to get in it more, and he didn't want to go there. But to me, it was more important. It was more important. If it would have been any other congressman besides Barr, it would not have been more important. but he's the most ardent anti-abortion foe in Congress. So that's what made it so significant.
What do you think that says about his character?
I think it says very little.
An excerpt of the news conference Larry Flynt held at the offices of his magazine, and that is Hustler magazine. We're joined right now by two people to talk about the significance of this expose and who's doing it. We're joined by Patricia Ireland, the president of the National Organization for Women, and Loretta Ross, executive director of the Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta, Georgia. She previously worked for the Center for Democratic Renewal, which monitors hate groups. Let's begin with Patricia Ireland. Your response to the continued surreal developments in Washington and around this country.
Well, I have to say it just gets worse. It's not a surprise that Bob Barr would be so hypocritical. We remember very well that he voted for the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, and you know the wags around Washington were saying, well, which of his marriages was he trying to defend, the first, the second, or the third? But it is, it's one of those situations where I fear people are just going to be so turned off and become so cynical about politics that we'll have an even greater fall off of participation.
Do you think that the allegations of Larry Flynt are legitimate ones? Not so much are they substantiated. He seemed to have the substantiation because he got an affidavit from Barr's second wife that very much laid out what happened at the end of their marriage when she got an abortion after having two children. But do you think it's legitimate to raise the issues that Flynt is raising, considering who he is? I mean, at the meeting, the press conference, he himself described himself as a smut peddler.
Well, does not, you know, whoever Larry Flynt may be does not change the facts of what he's uncovered. And, of course, we also know, I mean, Barr is consistent, remember very well, and I'm sure Loretta's prepared to address his association with the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is the successor to the White Citizens Councils that fought integration in sometimes a very violent way, and it's just part of his whole character. I do think it's legitimate in many ways, especially when you consider that he has equated invoking privilege with obstruction of justice. I don't think that's that's quite a stretch, but nevertheless, it does show the utter hypocrisy and the underlying partisan political nature of this.
Loretta Ross, you've worked on both issues that actually directly relate to Bob Barr, the very conservative Georgia Republican who worked with the Central Intelligence Agency and was an attorney for years before becoming a Congress member. You work on the issue of abortion for a long time and also on the issue of right-wing white hate groups. First, on the issue of abortion, one of the things that Bob Barr said in his statement to the revelations of Larry Flynt, he said, "I'm deeply saddened that Larry Flynt's money has been used in an attempt to drive a wedge between the mother and father of two wonderful boys who deserve better than to become involved in the politics of personal destruction." Barr went on to say, "I will not add to his efforts to attack me, my children, or the wonderful woman to whom I've been married for over the last 12 years by discussing our personal lives in any way, shape, or form with the news media." But he then said, "That being said, it's important to set the record straight on two accusations relating to issues on which I have taken a public stand. First, as an officer of the court for over 20 years, I've never perjured myself. Secondly, as a public official who's cast dozens of pro-life votes in the Congress and a strong opponent of abortion, I've never suggested, urged, forced, or encouraged anyone, including my ex-wife, to have an abortion." Now, I think that last line is very significant. "I've never suggested, urged, forced, or encouraged anyone, including my ex-wife, to have an abortion," because that doesn't really fly in the face of what she said in her affidavit. She didn't say that he forced her or encouraged her to. She simply said that he supported her in her own decision, something that a lot of pro-choice women say is just the role of what a partner should do. Now, what's problematic about that is in 1992, among many other times, he is quoted as saying, I would try to do everything in my power to stop my wife from having an abortion. He went on the floor of the House, equated abortion with murder. What about this issue of public and private life when it comes to a politician voting to criminalize something that he himself has been a part of, Loretta Ross?
Well, it's an interesting dilemma for us in the pro-choice movement because we've known actually for years about his wife Gail's abortion, but until she chose to make it public, we wouldn't make it public because, after all, it is a woman's private decision and we support that privacy. What's interesting in his statement is what he didn't say. He didn't deny that he paid for the abortion. And that's really at the heart of the matter, because ultra-conservatives like Bob Barr seem to believe that abortion should only be allowed in cases of rape, incest, and me, when I need one. And that's really the hypocrisy that we need to expose across the board, because unfortunately, Barr is not the only person who votes one way, but privately chooses to access services that he would deny to other women, particularly poor women. And so we're relieved that Gail made her abortion public so that we could finally talk about something we had known for years.
Now, some people say, come on, we're not getting down in the cesspool with Larry Flint here. These are personal matters. Do you think of this as getting down in the cesspool or actually this part of it being an important discussion?
I think it's an important discussion. We're bandying around the word sexual McCarthyism a lot. I think Alan Dershowitz gave us that term. And in fact, our politics have sunken to a gutter level when we deal with the impeachment and we deal with the exposing of people's personal lives. But right now, they're using personal lives as a political whip. And when they choose to do that, they set the terms of the debate, and we have a choice whether we choose to engage them on that. Barr, by making himself a central figure in accusing President Clinton and trying to lead his impeachment, has made himself vulnerable to having his own personal life examined, particularly when it so obviously contradicts what his public statements are.
Now, Loretta Ross, you not only deal extensively with the issue of abortion, but deal with white hate groups. And it's an issue we've taken on Democracy Now quite a lot. It's an issue that almost has gotten no attention, some good exposés, actually, in the Washington Post. But it's the story of the Council of Conservative Citizens. In the past month, Democracy Now! Has been covering Barr's association with the CCC, a white supremacist group that civil rights activists say is an updated version of the infamous White Citizens Council. He gave the keynote speech at the CCC's last conference in Charleston, South Carolina, where he stood in front of a Confederate flag. And on Democracy Now! We played an excerpt of that speech. Can you talk about the CCC and the kind of attention this has or has not gotten in the mainstream media?
Well, what the CCC has tried to do since its founding in 1985 is mainstream the ideology of white supremacy without using the invective, without using the N-word, but trying to create a gentler, kindler front for white supremacy. And they have had success in attracting mainstream politicians to speak at their events, like Barr and like Trent Lott and a number of other people. The problem that they have is that they still have as high as 10%, some reports say, of their membership are people who were in the Ku Klux Klan, who were in the Aryan Nation, who were in a number of hate groups. And they report, and this is the part I believe, that the people who are invited to speak at their event are familiar with the history of the organization, with the personnel of the organization. So when someone tries to deny that they don't know that the CCC is the successor to the White Citizens Council, again, I think they're simply lying. I think that they're playing a game, because you don't go out and speak. No politician goes out and speak to a group about which they know nothing, and particularly when they walk into a hall and they see this all-white audience with some real odious literature sitting around, like David Duke's book and books from William Pierce, the National Alliance, it would make anybody question, well, where am I? Some politicians, recognizing these odious connections, have backed out, but not Bob Barr. He was very proud to speak to them, very proud to be associated with them, And that really speaks to the racist side of his agenda, as well as his misogynist side and opposing abortion.
Loretta Ross, I had to ask you one quick question, which is something that has been rumored for a long time. I don't like to talk about rumors on national radio because we know they become fact right away, but it keeps being raised. We had Dick Gregory on who raised it, but lots of people raise it. And it is this question of, is Bob Barr a brother? It's something that is being talked about, particularly in the African-American community. Is he African-American?
I don't know.
Have you heard this rumor?
I've heard the rumor many, many times. Certainly down south, we have a history of people passing for white who have extreme Negroid features, and I think Bob Barr certainly fits that stereotype, but I generally don't know. I don't know what his antecedents are. I know that he is extremely, extremely connected, apparently, to people who are openly avowed racist. And that makes me question whether or not he's practicing some form of self-hatred or self-delusion. But his actual biological background, I have no information on.
Well, Loretta Ross and Patricia Ireland of National Organization for Women, we're going to ask you to stay with us. We just have to break for a minute for stations to identify themselves. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by Jeff Cohen of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Because interestingly enough, this is not getting a lot of attention, particularly the issue of abortion. While people know Larry Flynt had a news conference, very few actually got a chance to hear it. Most heard that it was something about Bob Barr having an affair, but not a lot of people heard it, unless they watched CNN, that he, in fact, was involved in this issue with his wife around an abortion. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Patricia Ireland, president of the National Organization for Women, Loretta Ross, executive director of the Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta, Georgia, previously worked for the Center for Democratic Renewal, which monitors hate groups, writes research reports and the activities of their members and traces their connection to mainstream groups and politicians. I also want to add one more thing on the issue from Georgia and House manager in the Senate impeachment trial, who has a connection to the CCC, but Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott as well has addressed the group, and his articles have appeared in the newsletter of the Council of Conservative Citizens, what many call the reincarnation of the white citizens' councils of the South, particularly in places like Mississippi. And we're joined by Jeff Cohen. He's the executive director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. While most of us have a lot of problems with Larry Flynt, particularly, and maybe I should just speak for myself here, when you think back to the woman in the meat grinder on the cover of Hustler magazine, which made him so famous in the 1970s. It's interesting to note that the revelations made at a widely publicized news conference in Beverly Hills were hardly covered by the media. We looked at the papers yesterday, the New York Times, Washington Post. Granted, it was late in the East Coast. It was 11 o'clock, 8 o'clock in Beverly Hills. While C-SPAN had promised viewers all-night live coverage of the news conference two nights ago, they pulled out at the last minute and didn't broadcast the news conference until 6 the next morning and then again yesterday afternoon. Coverage of Flynt's revelations today in the newspapers has remained scant, almost non-existent. The corporate media mainly dealing with the allegations of the affair he possibly had with while he was married to his second wife, and he eventually married the woman he was involved with, his third wife. But That is a very different issue than the issue of his second wife having an abortion and him supporting her in that, something that the wife has written in an affidavit that was gotten by Larry Flint. And we want to talk about how these issues are covered in the media, why perhaps C-SPAN chose not to cover it, although they had announced they'd be covering the original news conference. Jeff Cohen, what are your observations about what gets covered in this surreal circus today and what doesn't?
Well, it is indeed a circus. I mean, for the last year, you've had the mainstream media, the so-called quality prestige mainstream media, so deep in the muck of stained dresses and phone sex and oral sex. I think it was inevitable that at some point a professional pornographer would get right into the middle of the deal, and that's what Larry Flint has done. I think there's a lot of there's something. Fair has been very critical of the mainstream news media getting into sex lives when it doesn't affect things like truly public issues like sexual harassment. Consensual sex is something that in the past the mainstream media used to stay out of when it involved public figures. And now with the corporate takeover of the media, all the old rules, journalistic ethics is almost an oxymoron, all the old rules are out. Anything that can get you a short-term ratings, you get. And sex is certainly selling. I followed all of the coverage of Flint. Initially, it was slow. It's starting to come a little more, Flint and Barr. But, I mean, remember, Wolf Blitzer yesterday did a major interview with Barr. And my criticism of it is that the interview talked about the allegations of Barr's adultery, talked about the Flint news conference, talked about whether he had discouraged his ex-wife over an abortion, but not one word about Barr's support of the Council of Conservative Citizens. I would argue that there's almost nothing more important than a politician appearing with white supremacists and then lying about it. So, I mean, I believe that we may be stepping too far when we say, among our hundreds of criticisms of the mainstream media, I would put near the bottom that they are, you know, near the bottom of that list of criticisms of the mainstream corporate media is that they don't do enough to sexually out right-wing hypocrites. There's so many other things they do worse.
You know, it is interesting to note you were talking about CNN, that in their original report on the news conference, they did focus very specifically on the abortion charge. They showed a copy of the check that Barr's wife had given to the women's health clinic where she had an abortion. And they also talked about the fact that in the divorce proceeding, Barr said, which means he was under oath, that he had opposed the abortion, something that his second wife adamantly denies. She said if she had ever thought that her husband at the time, Bob Barr, had opposed the abortion, she wouldn't have gone through with it. And that goes to the issue of perjury.
No doubt. I mean, what we have now is allegations from a paid source, which is the second wife of Bob Barr, from Larry Flint, allegations of perjury. And as defenders of the White House have done for a year, you know, if you check divorce proceedings of public figures and politicians, you're going to find a lot of perjury. And you're going to find a lot of perjury about sex. And you're going to find a lot of perjury about sexual matters. And I think what Flint is trying to prove is, yeah, here's some evidence of it. It's just evidence. It's not proof.
You know, it's very interesting. Today in the Washington Post, there is an article entitled Controversial Group Has Strong Ties to Both Parties in the South. Again, it's this series that Tom Edsel has been doing in the Washington Post about the CCC. And he writes, the Council of Conservative Citizens, an organization built by supporters of the segregationist white citizens councils, the John Birch Society, and activists in the presidential campaigns of then-Alabama Governor George Wallace, has developed strong political ties to the Republican Party in the South, as well as to the fading conservative wing of the Democratic Party of the South. The group's strong ties to the remnants of the now defunct White Citizens Councils, a powerful force in Mississippi and other Deep South states in the 50s and 60s, gave it an organizational base as well as connections to small town establishments such as Rotary Clubs. The group soon became part of the political culture and both parties. Its ties to the Democratic Party are strongest in Mississippi. William Lord, the group's senior field coordinator, said 34 Mississippi legislators, most of them Democrats, are members of the council Council of Conservative Citizens, but most of the Southern politicians associated with it are Republicans, including members in state legislatures and in prominent state party positions. Senator Jesse Helms, Republican of North Carolina, and Mississippi Governor Kirk Fortas have been featured speakers. Fortas even enlisted the group's support for his legislative agenda. And it goes on to say, but it's two other Southern politicians, Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and Congressmember Bob Barr, who've brought the group its recent notoriety, and goes on from there. Loretta Ross, would you say that this is a bipartisan connection here?
Well, racism in the Deep South really knows no party affiliation. It's widespread enough. It's a big tent. It can take in both Democrats and Republicans. And the history of the CCC is tainted with association with known racists. They've been associated with the Aryan Nations, headquartered, a paramilitary group headquartered in Idaho. They've been associated with people from the National Alliance, which, of course, is headed by a guy named William Pierce, who wrote the Turner Diaries that Timothy McVeigh read before he blew up Oklahoma. And so these not-so-subtle connections should reveal to anybody paying the least bit of attention that this group has a political agenda around white supremacy and rolling back civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, immigrant rights, and that they should not be misled in thinking that this is just the most conservative wing of the conservative movement. In fact, decent conservatives are busily distancing themselves from the CCC because they know that it is not going to benefit their cause to be openly associating with such odorous people. But then you have people like Bob Barr, who thinks he can have it both ways, that he can flirt with racists, maybe be in bed with racists, and then pretend that he didn't know that he was in bed with them.
And, you know, Amy, one reason he can get away with it is because of the double standard in the mass media on this very public issue of who these politicians associate with. When black politicians ever shared a podium with Farrakhan, it became a news media obsession. Here you have Trent Lott in his most visible role in his life as the head of the Senate in the midst of an impeachment trial, who has been lying. His office had lied about Lott's extensive relationship with the Council of Conservative Citizens, you know, speaking to their events, his column, Trent Lott's column, has been published in the Citizens Informer, which is the CCC publication. You know, he's praised the group. They have the right principles and the right ideas. I mean, if this had been Farrakhan being praised by black politicians, we know the kind of news coverage that has engendered. But Bob Barr and Trent Lott have had these relationships with this organization, the White Racist Organization, and we can't get the reporters. There have been a lot of columnists getting into this, but the only reporter that's been on this at the national level is the one you named, Amy, Thomas Edsel of the Washington Post. FAIR has got all of this information on its website.
And I should point out one of the things they talk about in the Washington Post, photos of Lott at the group's gatherings in Mississippi and of Lott meeting in Washington with its officials have appeared periodically in the Citizens Informer, their newsletter. And then the issue of whether Lott's a member. In earlier statements, Lott's spokesperson avoided making a flat denial of claims by some council officials that he had been a member. The spokesman said he doesn't consider himself a member of the group and has no firsthand knowledge of the group's views. But Thomas Dover, the council president, said Lott, quote, certainly has his right to affirm or deny his membership. If he said no, I'll honor that for him. I'm not going to say one way or the other. If he wants to deny it, that's up to him. It also talks about his uncle, one of the founders of the White Citizens Council, Arnie Watson in Mississippi, who we had on Democracy Now! Just a few weeks ago. And when we asked him whether Trent Lott shares his points of view, there are photographs of him and his uncle and others meeting with Trent Lott in his office in Washington. Arnie Watson, his uncle, said that Trent's a Southern boy. So I did, though, want to take this a little away from this issue for a minute, because there's another issue in the news in the last 2 days, and that is that President Clinton has given an $850,000 check paying off the settlement he reached with Paula Jones, who accused him of exposing himself to her when she was an employee of the state of Arkansas at a hotel room. She had been brought up to the room where he was, and she said that he had pulled his pants down and tried to get her to in some way have sex with him, if we can say sex. I'm not sure what it is these days. But Patricia Ireland, National Organization for Women, took a lot of hits around the issue of Paula Jones case and not showing support for a woman who had charged that she was sexually harassed. What are your thoughts today on that final settlement?
Well, of course, we took our hits, and they were not well grounded. I think, of course, of Anita Hill and the dignity with which she comported herself, her really being pulled forward by a process of impeachment. Of confirmation of Clarence Thomas, and I think of Paula Jones, whose own sister said she smelled money, who had a lot of inconsistencies in her story, and despite that, we did reach out to her several times, including on Larry King, where she called into the show, and I agreed once again to meet with her, and she never took us up on it. But I think that there's a bigger picture in this. The other aspect of that whole case and of the Monica Lewinsky scandal has been that there's a great blurring of the lines of what sexual harassment is. We have, for years, had to deal with people like Bob Barr and others, Trent Lott, et cetera, who, you know, keep saying that, oh, the sexual harassment laws have gone way too far. I mean, you can't even touch your colleague on the shoulder when you congratulate her for doing a good job. But on the other hand, the judge in Arkansas said the interpretation of the current law is you can, if Paula Jones's story is true, you know, invite someone to your room, drop trousers, ask for oral sex, remind her on the way out the door that you're personal friends with her immediate supervisor, and that's not harassment. In the meantime, people are complaining about, you know, Clinton, and why aren't we saying anything about Monica Lewinsky? The only one who I can see has coerced Monica Lewinsky is Ken Starr. So it's been a real eye-opener in terms of how people actually perceive and understand what harassment is. If it is welcome, indeed, in Monica Lewinsky's case, if we're to believe the stories, it was actively pursued on her part, then it's not harassment. But I think that the bigger problem is, under cover of all of this voyeuristic hypocrisy that's going on in Washington, the members of Congress are going to continue with their vicious attacks on reproductive freedom, on affirmative action, equal opportunity for women, people of color, their opposition to a census in 2000 that includes rural and urban poor, or disproportionately people of color. All of these things that we've been talking about in terms of racism and sexism and homophobia come out in their legislative agenda, and you cannot tell how a member of Congress or any politician stands by their party platform. The Democrats ran anti-abortion candidates. We have got Hastert, who's the Speaker of the House and relatively unknown, who won't do us the favor of being as outspoken as Newt Gingrich, but whose record is every bit as conservative. So, you know, I think that this is a distraction in many ways, not to say it's not very serious, but the House is still going to move forward, and the Senate's not going to be much better on all of the issues that are implied in these discussions we're having.
Jeff Cohen, one of the things that Larry Flint said at his news conference when asked about paying sources, you know, he put this ad in $1 million to women who would come forward, say they had sex with Congress members. By the way, he's not going to be giving the money to the women who came forth about Livingston, because he ended up not publishing what they had to say. He was able to bring Livingston down before he published that, and some might say he's continuing to exploit women because they did come forward and got him a lot of attention. But he did give money to Bob Barr's wife. And he said, you're not going to want to hear this, journalists, but you're all going to be paying for sources soon. What do you say about that, Jeff Cohen?
I believe that he may be onto something, because the mainstream media have been continually going more and more into tabloid directions. Mainstream media already pay for interviews in the sense that they give people just lavish treatment and lavish travel and You know, they've done everything they could to get up to the edge of that rule of not paying for interviews. So it wouldn't surprise me. We've seen all sorts of rules being broken in the last few years as mainstream television especially imitates tabloid television. Some of the news magazines are gone tabloid. I mean, Newsweek has just feasted on the sex story for the last year, consensual sex. Newsweek has a reporter. When you think of this scandal, it always gets compared by Republicans to Watergate. If there's a Woodward and Bernstein in the press on Sexgate or Monica Gate, it would be Michael Isikoff, whose beat for years at Newsweek has basically been the president's sex life. But I want to say one thing that hasn't come up is this. One thing that I've noticed in the last few days is a very oddball alliance, a coalition. The coalition involves the religious right on the one hand, and on the other, the pornographer, Larry Flint. Because when you think about it, in American society today, there are two groups that are really pushing this idea that every politician should talk about their sex life. Larry Tate and the Christian Coalition and others on the religious right, they have said repeatedly in the last weeks they want journalists to ask all politicians and every presidential candidate, have you ever committed adultery? So if that question is now going to be what journalists focus on, then clearly it would be, if that's okay, clearly it's okay for Larry Flint to come along and say, look, we got to provide the research so you know whether the politician answered the question correctly. So there's this sort of weird tag team partnership of the religious right on the one hand, and I think increased pornography in the media on the other. And the way for this has all been paved by the mainstream media with their sex obsession over the last year.
Well, Jeff Cohen, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, based in New York. Patricia Ireland, President of the National Organization for Women. She is in Washington, D.C. And Loretta Ross, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta, Georgia. It's been an enlightening discussion. Thank you all. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. In the first ever attempt to hold U.S. retailers accountable for mistreatment of workers in foreign-owned factories operating on U.S. soil, litigation is being filed today in California and Saipan against 18 high-profile U.S. clothing manufacturers and retailers, including The Gap, Tommy Hilfiger, May Company, Sears, and Walmart. Saipan is a part of the Northern Mariana Islands, a U.S. commonwealth in the South Pacific. It's just about an hour's flight from Guam. It's a place I spent a little time about 7 years ago. These companies are accused of violating federal law by engaging in a racketeering conspiracy using indentured labor, predominantly young women, to produce clothing on the island of Saipan. Their foreign-owned garment contractors in Saipan are also charged with failing to pay overtime and creating intolerable work and living conditions. In the last 5 years, contractors in Saipan have received more than 1,000 citations for violating U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards, many of which characterize capable of causing death or serious injury. There are two federal class action lawsuits filed on behalf of more than 50,000 workers from throughout Asia, China, Philippines, Bangladesh, Thailand. The workers allegedly drawn to Saipan with promises of high pay. Instead, they found themselves working up to 12-hour days, 7 days a week, oftentimes off the clock without receiving any pay or overtime. And a third companion lawsuit filed in California state court today by four national human rights and labor organizations, Global Exchange, Sweatshop Watch, Asia Law Caucus, and Unite. The lawsuit accuses the retailers of using misleading advertising and trafficking in hot goods manufactured in violation of U.S. labor laws. We did part of this story last week on Democracy Now, where we talked about the fact that manufacturers particularly like Saipan, because you can have a Made in USA label, but Saipan, because it's a U.S. Commonwealth, but not in having the full status of the United States, for example, does not have to abide by minimum wage laws. We're joined right now by two people. We're joined by the man who is spearheading the lawsuit, attorney Al Meyerhoff, and we're joined by Carmencita Abad, who's a witness to what goes on in Saipan. In fact, she's a garment worker herself from the Philippines and has worked at The Gap and Levi Strauss, Tommy Hilfiger, some of the companies which, not all of them, Levi Strauss not included here, are being sued today. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Al Meyerhoff, explain the suit.
Well, the litigation challenges a system of indentured servitude, of indentured labor, in the Northern Marianas Islands, which are an American Commonwealth, much like Puerto Rico legally. It's a system where literally thousands of young women are recruited in the villages of mainland China, Bangladesh, the Philippines, Thailand. They are recruited and told they're coming to America for a better life and better working conditions, and they're brought to the garment factories of Saipan. Part of the recruitment process is to get them to promise to pay up to $7,000 in fees for the right to work in these factories. And when they get the Saipan, what they find is, unlike what was promised, they find factories that are in violation, flagrant violation of American labor laws, and they live up to six to a room in barracks that are encircled by barbed wire and sometimes with guards and guard dogs. In those factories, they would work up to 70 hours a week. They're frequently not paid overtime. They're required to do so-called volunteer time, and their living conditions are highly unsanitary and would violate any American labor law.
I think a lot of people are going to be shocked by this, because with all the information coming out on what happens to foreign workers in foreign lands as a result of U.S. companies, I bet people have been looking at those labels and feel relieved when they say Made in USA. But these labels, in fact, are not necessarily a sign that the workers are being well treated. We're also joined, as we said, by Carmencita Abad, who is a witness to these U.S. companies on U.S. soil. Because she's worked in those plants. She is a garment worker. Carmencita, can you tell us the company you work for and the U.S. manufacturers that this company produces garments for?
I'm working in Saco Corporation, who produces most of the time the product Gap.
You said for the Gap?
Yes.
What other corporations do you make clothes for?
Clothes for sometimes Levi Strauss, sometimes L.A. Gear, sometimes Banana Republic, sometimes Amanda Smith, sometimes, Anne Klein.
Anne Klein.
Anne Klein, yes.
Can you tell us what the conditions in your factory were like in Saipan?
The conditions in the factory where I work is a little bit better than those factories, other factories that surrounds my factory. They treated Chinese unfairly, unlike us Filipinos, and they had poor working conditions. Because, these Chinese people who couldn't express themselves and afraid to, complain, is a example. The Gatsik, they are not permitted to leave the factory until it is finished or working the until the finish it not finishes its work like that. Unlike us, we are told to, you know, if Gatsik, we are permitted to leave.
Now, are they working in the same factory as you or in different factories for different companies?
What I'm saying is working with my company.
One of the allegations in the complaint is that workers are treated differently and that there's disparate treatment between those workers who are willing to stand up or able to stand up for their rights more than others. And the Chinese workers are particularly the subject of different kinds of threats and intimidation. They are brought from China where the conditions are repressive to begin with, and then they're put in a climate where they are subject to different kinds of psychological and even sometimes physical threats against their well-being. And part of what Qi has seen is particularly acts like that against the Chinese workers. It's not so much they're singled out as they are simply, there's more, they come from conditions where they are more subject to the kinds of controls that would also be present in Saipan, and a number of these factories are owned by and controlled by Hong Kong Chinese and other companies that are foreign companies that simply have more intimidation and more effective intimidation on the Chinese workers and to some lesser degree the Bangladeshi workers than on the Filipino workers. It's simply the way the system seems to operate there.
So if you, L. Meyerhoff, can explain exactly what is the principle in which you brought, there are different kinds of lawsuits, is that right? You've got class action suits as well as others.
Right. There's three separate lawsuits that are actually being filed on Wednesday. The predominant legal theory for all of them is that there are flagrant violations of American laws that prohibit indentured labor and voluntary servitude, violations of OSHA, the failures to pay overtime, the requirements of volunteer work that are imposed. And it's the first time, to my knowledge, that the upstream retailers, companies like The Gap and JCPenney and Walmart and Sears, are being held accountable for the conditions in the garment industry by the factories. We're suing both the foreign-owned factories, but we're also suing the retailers. And I think the point you made before is well taken, which is that most American consumers, when they see the Made in USA label, that should stand for something. They believe that it means that the goods were manufactured either by American workers or at least workers that were protected by American laws and the production was under certain kinds of conditions. And here we have nearly $1 billion in textiles coming into the continental United States every year from Saipan, manufactured under conditions that violate not only American values but also a series of American laws. There, I would point out, these goods are also coming in duty-free. If these goods were being manufactured in China or in Thailand, then at least there would be a tariff control. Here the goods come in duty-free, and yet they're manufactured under many of the same conditions that you would find elsewhere in the world.
And what now is the timetable for this? You're filing this today in Saipan and in Los Angeles, is that right?
That's right. There's actually three cases, a case being filed in Saipan, a class action for systematic failure to pay overtime, many hours of work that are voluntary. We're filing another class action in Los Angeles in federal court under RICO. That is the federal racketeering statute that prohibits violations of various laws, including laws that prohibit indentured servitude. And then we're filing a third case in state court, actually in California, against the retailers seeking disgorgement of profits and restitution for unfair business practices, false advertising, and the like. So it's a series of lawsuits all being filed in combination.
Is there anything else, Al Meyerhoff, that you feel it's important to let our listeners know about as you go off now for your news conference?
Well, I think the point I would make is that the retail industry has in the past in this country claimed they simply are unaware of what's happening by the garment companies in foreign countries, that it is beyond their control. But these conditions are happening on American soil. As a matter of law, this could be Vermont as easily as it is Saipan. The laws are equally applicable. And the retailers that we're suing here have people on the ground. They have people that are doing inspections for quality control on a regular basis, and yet they're closing their eyes to conditions that are a flagrant violation of the law. So the hope here, the goal, the intent is to make them accountable for the conditions in Saipan.
And, Chi, what would you like to see come out of this lawsuit? What would you like to see accomplished? And do you feel you can now go back to Saipan and work in one of these plants?
All I want is, changes in it. Changes for the better, for especially to Chinese workers who must be treated equally as us Filipinos.
What do the workers say to you? Do they know that you've come to the United States to be a part of this lawsuit?
No. Some knows that I'll be a part, but in my company, no, they don't know anything.
And why did you decide to deal with the plight of people who are not only your country people from the Philippines, but you are not personally hurt by these working conditions? It's, for example, as you said, Chinese workers.
I believe in myself that, without a person ask me, there would be nothing changed at all. What I mean is, without me, this expose will not come out like this, because it's hard for a Chinese, to express themselves, and they don't know anything,
The U.S. corporations that have been exposed for bad working conditions in other countries, for example, the Gap in Latin America, often say they don't know what a contractor does and that it's not their responsibility. Well, they aren't quite able to give that answer anymore because there's been a lot of scrutiny and now they do know. But do you think they could make that argument in Saipan that they don't know what the contractor you work for is doing to the workers?
I don't believe so. As far as I know, they know. They know really what's going on.
No, I would just point out there have been a series of congressional reports and reports from the United States Department of Interior, reports from human rights groups, for several years now, documenting the conditions in the Saipan garment industry, including a report that came out only last week from the U.S. Department of Interior. So the conditions there are well documented, and for a major American corporation to claim lack of knowledge is simply, it strains credulity.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Al Meyerhoff, who is spearheading the lawsuits that are being brought today against the various manufacturers for making clothes under terrible conditions in Saipan, which is the U.S. Commonwealth in the Pacific. Again, the companies that are being sued, The Gap, Tommy Hilfiger, May Company, Sears, and Walmart. Al Meyerhoff also joining us, Carmencita Abad, who's just come from Saipan, who is a garment worker on the island herself. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion with help from Norman Kelly. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.